きの山。
Are you open? Oh, sorry. Just a minute. Hi.
Where are you going?
37 East 28th Street.
37 East 28th.
That's right.
You gotta tell me where to go, man. I don't know, I cannot, you know.
Okay.
I can't read your mind here. At least I have the ESP.
Just a voice check. So, just like you heard me say with Rizwan yesterday, what did you have for breakfast today?
Oh, I had, actually I didn't get up until 11 o'clock, so I didn't have breakfast. What I did have was, I had a salad. I had a spinach scallion, garlic, raw garlic, and bean curd salad.
That sounds very good.
Yeah, well, you know, healthy, all that nonsense, you know. It's
okay. So, if you could just say, so that people listening will know who you are, my name is...
My name is Kevin Michael Fitzpatrick, and I've been driving a cab for, off and on, for over 30 years.
Okay, can you say that one more time?
I've been driving a cab off and on for over 30 years.
And my name is...
My name is Kevin Michael Fitzpatrick.
Okay, so, first of all, you've been doing this for so long, so I'm just wondering... Tell me a little bit about when you first started driving, who were the drivers out on the streets?
Oh, 1971. I drove during the summers. It was a college job. You drove during the summers. It was, at that time, most of the cab drivers would have been native-born Americans, a lot of African-Americans, a lot of Puerto Ricans, and, a lot of, like white Americans. That would have been the city, the ethnic composition of the city around 1971. Now, it started changing in the 80s and especially in the 90s. You know, this is a job you can't export. So, you know, you bring the sweatshop here. It's a lot of this had to do, so-called reforms in the industry. Deregulation normally in America means, cutting wages and benefits. It's this happened continuously in this industry. 30 years ago, people worked less hours, they made more money. Now, the hours are longer, in real terms, the wage is probably down about 30%.
Okay, so when did you first observe, was there a moment when you started to say to yourself, well, the people I'm working with now as a driver, the people who are doing the same job I am, don't look like me anymore? When did you realize that?
Oh, well, this is, you realize it on certain levels. You realize it on theoretical levels. You realize it on emotional levels. You see, let's say with South Asians started coming into the industry around the middle 80s. Yeah, there'd always been like a lot of Haitians in the industry. Before that, Dominicans. But around, middle, late 80s, South Asians started coming into the industry. You know, it's something, it doesn't come like one day. It's all native-born American, and the next day it's, all, immigrants.
Sorry, one second. I didn't wait. Okay,
yeah, normally most of them don't. Okay.
Sorry.
Thank you for calling the New York Taxi Workers Alliance. The office is open Monday through Thursday, 2 p.m. until 10 p.m., and on Fridays from 2 p.m. until 8 p.m. Please leave a message with your name, phone number, and the best time to reach you. Our fax number is 646-638-4446. Thank you.
Let's see what happens. So you're saying it doesn't change overnight?
No, it takes some time. It's basically in the late 80s to middle late 80s, you also have a general change in the population in New York. It's a lot less native born Americans and a lot more immigrants. In this industry, it tends to be, mostly South Asians. But, for example, you see in delis, all the counter help is Mexican now. Even 10 years ago, 15 years ago, Mexicans would have been fairly rare in New York, I mean, there were thousands of them, but, now it's a couple hundred thousand.
Now, I know that now you're a really big part of this organization and everything, but, did that make you feel uncomfortable at any point, seeing the changing face here?
No, not really. It's one thing in the cab is if you don't involve yourself, you tend to be very isolated. You have a few people you talk to, and that's it. Remember, you're out there. One of the problems in the industry, for taxi drivers, is sometimes you see the other drivers as competition. There's one reason why it's so hard to organize people, I think. This goes back to when it was all Americans, too. It's, in New York has always been fairly diverse. So people, instead of speaking Spanish, they speak Urdu, in one sense, big deal, it's.
Interesting. So, tell me a little bit about how you were saying the conditions of driving changed a lot over time. I mean, what was it like when you started as compared to now?
Oh, the day shift. When I first started working, I would start at 7 and I would finish at 3. 8 hours plus, you go and eat, do whatever. Now a shift is, real shift is, 11 hours. When I worked days, I would start at 5:30, I would finish about 4:30. So. Longer hours.
And how about the pay?
The pay, in real terms, has probably gone down. When I first started, you had a pension, you had hospitalization, health insurance. That's gone down the tube. So, plus, besides the cash value, you figure health insurance, maybe $4,000 or $5,000 a year right there. It wasn't much of a pension, but it was a pension.
Who gave you the pension?
Initially, back then, the job was unionized. It was Local 3036, SEIU. Back then, you had a much more traditional type of organization. Drivers, they worked on commission. They worked out of garages. That would have been 75, 80% of drivers, or more than that, 85% of drivers. Now, traditional fleets are down to about 20% of the, and all the fleets lease.
And what do you have instead of the traditional fleet? What are most people doing?
Most people now lease from brokers. They what's called horse hiring. It's basically you rent a cab. It'd be roughly equivalent to tenant farming or sharecropping.
Why do you make that comparison?
Oh, those are the most apt, I think. The ones, basically, you do away with the employee-employer contract, you know, status. People become independent contractors. They try to tell you, well, you're a small businessman. Now, for example, if you're a sharecropper, well, I suppose you're a small businessman, too. Although back then, they wouldn't have, put so much, you know, icing on, you know, the pile of shit, basically. Icing on the cake. But, back then would have been racial supremacy, you know. Well, you know, you're doing it because, you know, you're black and you don't have anything else, you know, that's the way it goes. Here it's... now the story the bosses give is the miracle of immigrants striving, you know, ever upward, you know. Well, maybe, probably not. Mostly it's exploitation. Taxi owners, but this has always been a rather sleazy industry. It goes right back to the 20s when it was run by gangsters. Gangsters used taxi cabs to move their liquor, and also it's a cash business. You could, you know, bury the money in the taxi, you know, in the taxi receipts. And, you know, basically, you know, it's always been run like a sweatshop or a slum or slumlords. Basically, take as much as you can, get as much of out of the industry without putting anything into it.
Back then it was unionized, and the union provided a pension, but now there's still, you said there's still some of that. There's still some small fleets, right?
Well, all the fleets now, they lease cabs like the brokers do. What happens is now brokers have various deals. Some is you lease cabs, some you buy the car and you lease the medallion. This way, basically, the idea is to privatize the profits and socialize the risks. You pay, let's say you lease a cab for, $105 a shift. This is, now, if it's a slow day, you can wind up paying money for the cab, work 12 hours and wind up giving the boss $20, let's say. It's... guys are talked into signing these bogus contracts, which basically give them no rights. You can't even quit. Sometimes it's a sub-minimum wage job, and you can't even quit it. It's, you wind up, then the broker takes you to court. And the TLC, the Taxi and Limousine Commission, will enforce a judgment. What they do is they suspend your hack license.
It sounds like it was a better gig when you started.
Yes, definitely. Well, that's true for almost all jobs in the United States now.
And was there ever a point when you said, I've had it, I'm going to do something else?
Well, you reach points as you get older, too. You know, your ability to switch jobs becomes smaller and smaller. So.
Right. So how did you get involved here? How did you even hear about it?
Oh, well, in 1998, Giuliani, the mayor of New York at that time, proposed all these changes in taxi regulations. Basically, what it was increasing the fine level 400-500%. This is basically immigrant bashing. You really wanted to make sure. Well, what it boiled down to was, you know, you had to make sure that white women, you know, like, would feel safe, you know, driving with, you know, like, Asian immigrants.
You
know?
Think so?
Oh, yeah.
Well,
yeah.
Why do you say that? I mean, they called it safety rules, right?
Well, no. I mean, in fact, taxi drivers were the safest bunch in the city. You know, if you wanted to have safety rules, you know, maybe you'd make the police, you know, like, put safeties on the guns, you know? Nobody's... No, it's basically, if anything, I've been in the business long enough to know drivers now are much safer, than they were 20 years ago. They, there are less scams being pulled on customers, things like that. But, this man, you know, Giuliani is a neo-fascist. And, you know, you always, if you're a neo-fascist, you need... you need the other, you know, whatever you want to call it. But, you know, this was part of his program. You know, he's gonna, you know, he's gonna keep them under control.
And you feel it was anti-immigrant? I mean,
oh yes,
you're not an immigrant.
No, I'm not, but I'm an exception to the rule. It's you know, they don't single out, well, you know, like, we'll apply all these rules except to, you know, Kevin Fitzpatrick or Bob Smith. It's basically the group you're in. I live in East New York, which is mostly a, you know, black and Hispanic neighborhood, and, well, you get lousy services. Now, I know, for example, we were the last neighborhood to get cable TV, I mean, if you're into TV, and we were the first neighborhood to have water meters put in. You know, that's an example of your political power, or lack of thereof. But yeah, this is, you know, I'm realistic. I see how these things work.
And what do you think he was trying to do with the rules? It was
basically pandering to his base.
Which is who?
His political base is, you know, like white, you know, working people. A lot, well, conservative, you know, types who, and also yuppie types who are complaining about, oh, taxis are so expensive. Oh, I had to wait 20 minutes for a taxi in the rain. Well, you know, these things happen. You know, why don't, you know, I wouldn't wait 20 minutes for a cab. I'd go to the next block and take a subway. This is logic, but it's, now everybody has a story about, like, a crazy cab driver. Even cab drivers have stories about crazy cab drivers. And it's, you know, it's perception. You know, cab drivers drive crazily. And, you know, they're visible. And, you know, they're a non-white population.
Why do you think everyone has a story about a crazy cab driver?
Because every cab driver once in a while loses it. And there are, in any business, hey, look, everybody has a story about a crazy cop, right? Everybody has a story. Everybody can tell you stories. Some people who use lawyers tell you stories about crazy lawyers. It's crazy teachers. It's always, in any group, you're going to find, you know, a couple of crazy people.
And you're saying that makes
that's sense. What people remember. People don't remember, you know, most interactions with cab drivers and passengers are fairly neutral. They're not particularly friendly. They're not particularly nasty. You know, you go from point A to point B, you know, you say thanks a lot, end of story, and you go on to something else. It's, you know, you always remember the nut. And it's the same thing in anything.
So Giuliani was taking advantage of that?
Oh, yes, definitely. He did. That's how he got elected. You know, he got elected on people's resentment. And nowadays, people resentments are, you know, in America, it's always been blacks. Now, you know, it's immigrants, you know, oh, they're taking our jobs.
Okay.
You know, they have different customs, you know, their food smells, you know, the usual.
Mm-hmm. Okay, now, so you got involved here in 98. So you were telling me how you heard about it.
Okay, well, actually, after that, you know, they decided on a strike on May 13th, 1998. Now, actually before that, there'd been the old union collapsed in 1996. That was Local 3036. It had become a corpse, and there was time to, the union had agreed to leasing in 1985, which at that point, if drivers were independent contractors, the union should have dissolved.
What does it mean, leasing as opposed to what?
Oh, as opposed to commission. Commission, you're considered an employee. And, you know, they, you know, you get a regular paycheck, you know, taxes taken out, all of that.
Okay.
And, you know, the value of the medallion when leasing started was about $28,000. Now it's $360,000. Give you an idea of the profits they made on this.
Mm-hmm. So the only way you'd afford that is you'd be a garage owner. And you would buy, you know, pool a bunch of money, buy a medallion for a cab and lease that out for.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Basically, with leasing, they, as I said, they privatized the profits, you know. So you could wind up, the owner would make, let's say it's a bad day. The owner would make, he would make his 100, let's say 105 a day for the ship. And the driver might take home 20. Or him, the driver might not take home anything.
Now, can you explain how that, if I wanted, if how does a medallion get from the Taxi and Limousine Commission onto a cab on the street?
Well, actually, for like 60 years, they were set. There was a set number. In 1996, under Giuliani, they issued 400 new ones, and Bloomberg has issued 600 new ones now. So, the total was it was an 11,787 for like 55 years, and it went up to now it's 12,187. When the medallions were first issued, you know, you didn't have livery cabs or black car groups or anything. So, you know, there's a lot more need of cabs now. Well, seen that way, perceived that way.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Drivers, most yellow cab drivers would not support the issuance of new medallions. They see this as a way of protecting themselves.
From competition.
Yeah.
But can you just sort of talk me through how a garage owner buys a medallion and... just for people listening who
A lot of the fleets actually go back to the 20s and the 30s. These guys, there's a group called the Metropolitan Taxi Board of Trade. This is all the old fleet, you know, old line fleets. They were actually, a lot of them go back to the 1930s. They were basically, you know, as I was telling you before, they were originally run by gangsters. And one of the problems with gang, you know, you have a real problem running a business when you can't count, you know, more than 10, you know, you have to use your toes. Gangsters, I don't know if you've ever met any mafia or so, but they're really stupid. It's, the guys become mafioso because they're too lazy and too dumb to do a real job. But anyway, they had the problem, they couldn't run fleets, so they had associates run it for them. This is how the mob works, you know, you have the sworn soldiers and everything, and then they have their business associates. And these guys were associates in the mob. They were around for about 40, 50 years. And a big change, until 1971, the police department used to run, you know, taxi regulation. In 1971, they set up what was called the Taxi and Limousine Commission.
So you're saying how the Taxi and Limousine Commission is?
Yeah, this was set up under Mayor Lindsay. And now the official story was crime was bad in 1971, so they wanted to take cops out of regulating cabs and, you know, like fight crime. In fact, I mean, they had a taxi squad. The taxi squad was like 100 guys who were reaching retirement. They were too fat, you know, to actually fight crime, so they put them, you know, like regulating taxes. But it was really a payoff to the Queen's Democratic Organization for supporting him in his re-election bid. And I don't know if you've ever dealt with the Queen's Democratic Organization, but make sure you keep your wallet well secured. You know, it's a very corruption-prone organization. As a matter of fact, the first head of the Taxi and Limousine Commission was a guy, Michael Lazar. Michael Lazar wound up going to jail, not so much for the TLC, but for, he became a quote-unquote developer on 42nd Street.
Okay.
But this is this was a payoff. Then now after once you get to TLC, leasing starts really. The police department, for various reasons, always kept, you know, we do it this way. And in 1973, a fleet was sold, and taxis have always been divided into groups of two. And, they call them mini fleet. And the reason for this...
I'm sorry to have to keep...
I know who this guy is. I told him, you know, these people, like, they come with a ticket the day before it's due. And there's always a screw-up, and then he always comes screaming at us, you know? The office is not open now, so...
Thank you for calling the New York Taxi Workers Alliance. The office is open Monday through Thursday...
You think it's the same person calling over and over?
Yeah.
...and on Fridays from 2 p.m. until 8 p.m. Please leave a message with your name, phone number, and the best time to reach you. Our
fax number is 646-638-4446.
Thank you.
See, that'd be video calling.
Okay, well, why don't we talk about, you're talking about the mini fleets.
Oh, okay. So they did this for insurance purposes, basically to limit liability. That, you know, if in the worst case where all they could lose would be the two medallions, and the fleet was technically only a management company, they have 150,000 scams to, you know, avoid paying anything. On the other hand, you know, you dent one of their calves and they're going to bill you for thousands of dollars. You know, typical, you know, like sleazeball businessmen, basically. But yeah, so once you broke it up, there was, they began leasing the cabs to the drivers. And, I blame a lot of this on the old union, that they didn't go after them hammering, you know, tongue, but they didn't. I know, guy, we know guys who were active in the old union, and they had a rank-and-file caucus there. And I remember I was talking to a guy from it, and he was saying that they decided at one point they were going to stop the practice. And so one fleet sells out, and the union did nothing. And they said, well, how come you're not doing anything? And the union management said, oh, well, he was a nice guy, you know. Whether they were paid off a week, nobody knows, but. You know, you don't need a union to sell you out your interest. You can do that on your own.
Okay. So this union sort of buckled in 96. And then how did you even hear about this? What was happening?
Well, everybody, it was spontaneous, basically. Everybody was angry, you know. Probably everybody was angry, scared, and they made it much easier for you to lose your license and everything. And so everybody decided to fight back. And I figured, well, let me go check this out, you know. I mean, in this industry, you have a tendency, owners, you know, like try to, you know, create these... false community of interest with drivers, you know. Oh, let's do this together. Well, actually it means let the drivers do the work and, you know, let us collect the money. But, you know, I've always, most people are suspicious of organizations. And normally, you know, it's they take your money, they do nothing. It's, the old union left a very bad taste in people's mouths. At the end, you were paying $3 a shift, and the money was going into a pension fund that you could never collect from. Only people had hired before 1985. So you're paying $90. Let's say you work 25 shifts. You're paying $75 a month. That's a lot of union dues, and I mean for a union that gave you absolutely nothing.
Okay. So you heard about this, and you had every reason to be suspicious of it.
Well, yes, I checked it out, and.
as if any of it makes a difference.
Yeah, well, yeah, you're going to get a lot more industrial pollutants and everything.
Yeah, that's true. And at least we enjoy brain tumors from cell phones. So.
Yeah, yeah, well, I mean, at least we got it from doing drugs and drinking and everything.
That's a good point. Okay, so I guess you were talking about how you had a reason. I wanted to know, well, you had a reason to be suspicious about it. So when you heard about it, what'd you do?
Oh, well, they had a strike headquarters over on 8th Avenue by Port Authority. Well, I walked over, you know, see what it was like. And, yeah, it was, yeah, I believed I could trust these people.
Why?
The politics seemed real, you know, fairly good. You can usually tell. I mean, hey, look, these people look pretty radical, so I feel you can usually trust, you know, these type of people.
Okay. So that was when?
Oh, that was in 98. So May of 1998.
2 weeks before the strike?
No, just the day of the strike.
The day of the strike you walked over?
Yeah, well, I mean, you know, in a taxi strike, a strike like that, you know, they're not massive picket lines. Most people just stay home, you know, and it's, yeah, you know, they, you know, people stay home and, you know, they do their business and everything. But the fact is, I got off at Port Authority. I looked, I didn't see a yellow cab on 8th Avenue. Now, that meant the strike's effective. I mean, I feel, well, if we got 50, 60% of people, it'd be a good strike. I mean, we wound up getting about 94% of people. It was really a very spontaneous strike. It's people, guys who just print up leaflets and hand them out themselves and everything. It's really the way it should be done. You know, it was, at that time, taxi workers was really more of a, you know, like the lens than a mass organization. Not that many people knew about it.
Right. And so you came over and you saw, well, first of all, were you driving your cab that day?
No. No, hey, I'm not a scab.
No, because it sounded like you walked over and found out about the organization.
Oh, no, I took the subway. I took the subway and found out about it.
Okay, so you agreed to go with it even before you knew who these people were.
Well, I wasn't gonna drive, but I was gonna check it out if, you know, if I thought these people were clowns or the normal industry nonsense, I would have, you know, said, have a nice day.
But you didn't?
No.
Okay. So what did it feel like? I mean, tell me what it's like for you as a driver. I mean, had there ever been a strike like this
before? There have been strikes before, not in my time. Actually, one of the things that they were big, drivers used to be big on was these big, massive driver caravans. You would, actually, normally they were protesting things like, oh, well, you know, crimes against cab drivers, things like that. Now you get a couple of thousand cabs and everybody be honking their horns and you block traffic. That was the normal way of doing it. A strike was something, they'd done it in the 60s when they first got the union. And, but normally for a long time it had been like the taxi caravan, you know, the big drive-by.
Now, there were some problems with Giuliani over the caravan, right? What?
That came a week later. Now, Giuliani and his hench person, McKechnie, they figured, oh, well, there's going to be no strike. You know, they figured a couple hundred people would take off and that'd be it. And, you know, like 94%, I mean, it was Giuliani was in a rage. Because, you know, this is a man who doesn't like people talking back to him. And, I mean, he was talking about, oh, well, we're going to make every Tuesday cab-free day and everything. He wanted to bring, you know, liveries, let them make street pickups and... you know, the normal, the man is a very vicious animal, Giuliani. He has, you know, there's a man who remembers slights. You know, and I mean, he came down on us for the next 3 or 4 years. Then it became really bad. Well, oh, then you had the 2 weeks later, there's going to be another job action. Part of it included, you know, the taxi caravan. And normally what they would do when they'd have the big drive-by, you have to have a place to organize, to assemble. And Giuliani essentially did a preemptive strike. He went to the area in Long Island City, put all no standing anytime stand signs around, and nobody could get into, they never had a chance to organize it. And he banned empty cabs from coming into the city for about 7 hours. Totally illegal, but that never mattered much to our own little Mussolini.
Like to stop the motor.
Yeah, well, he figured if don't let the cabs in, they won't. There's this lawsuit going on that still.
I thought a federal judge said it was illegal.
Oh yeah, he didn't have the right to do it, but. Republican scum like Giuliani, they ignore court orders. They say they never heard about them.
But this group did take it to court and a judge.
Yeah, they won. They won. And the thing, if guys lost the shift in the cab, they wanted financial compensation. I don't know if they ever. Oh. That's still up.
Okay, so there were like three separate actions, right? One was the strike. One was a kind of combination strike and motorcade.
Yeah.
That didn't really, the strike sort of worked and the motorcade sort of
worked. Yeah, basically, owner drivers tended to be, the people who led these things. That was basically, the death knell for the owner drivers as an organized political force. Basically, Giuliani threatened to, take their medallions away and everything. And these guys were terrified. They'd never been a, property makes you coward. That's.
Mm-hmm. And then we had the third action.
Oh, the third was a complete fiasco. That was more because of the other organizations we were with. We had set a deadline for when to do the strike, and they kept putting it off. And by the time we got to it, it was so, you can't call a strike on an hour's notice. People need time to know what's happening.
What was happening there specifically?
Well, we were going to have a third. It was basically going to be a strike. No cabs go out. And, some of the owner groups and owner driver groups, they want, let's talk and, let's see what the judge says. And, we said, we have to decide by, I think it was 5 p.m. You have to have some time to give people notice. But, it wound up dragging so long that nobody knew whether it was a strike or not. It was a complete fiasco the third time.
And did anyone end up striking? Oh, wait, was it just that some groups were saying there was a strike and other groups were saying?
Well, yeah, nobody was quite sure what's happening. Some people... Everybody would say, well, let's put it off, and you can't put it off. You can only put it off to a certain amount of time. This takes a lot of planning and organization. And you can't call up at 4 a.m. in the morning and say, we're not sending out the day shift. It's too late.
Right. Okay, so.
And, you can't expect drivers to know, when they're getting two or three different conflicting messages, they're just going to say, to hell with this.
No. In the end, the strike didn't, the TLC passed almost all of those rules.
Yes.
And so, what do you think? Was it a success? Or?
Yes, I think it was. First of all, the fact that they would have passed these things anyway. It was, we were able to get them ameliorated through the city council. Originally, they wouldn't just give you one ticket. They'd give you a TLC ticket and a DMV ticket. And they're claiming because their computers weren't linked together. So, double jeopardy. The city came down very hard after. Giuliani gave the cops orders, hit the cab drivers, with everything you can. Guys would drop off at Penn Station. They were like 15 inches from the curb. Now, technically, you have to drop within 12 inches of the curb. They would wind up with $1,200 worth of tickets.
That's
Mr. Nice Guy, But, yeah, this went on. We were able to get a lot of the rules changed and everything. We got kicked in the teeth a lot. But hey, you know, sometimes, you know, sometimes that's the way it goes. It's, you know, you can't expect to fight them and not expect them to hit back.
Was the cost worth what you gained, though? I mean,
yeah,
sounds
I think
like it was
so.
A pretty great cost to participate.
It was a high cost, but I think, hey, look, suppose your country is attacked. You know, you're going to lose a lot of people fighting back. You know, is it worth the cost? It's, you know, it's a decision you have to make.
And, I mean, what did you lose through participating? Did you lose anything? I mean, you lost some money, I'm sure.
Oh, yeah. Well, you know, hey, I'm single. You know, I would have just blown the money anyway. But, hey, guys with families, you know, they had their license suspended. But, hey, look, Giuliani would have done it anyway. It's some people would say, oh, we should keep quiet, you know, and they won't enforce it all. But that's not the way Giuliani works. Giuliani tended to go after groups that were considered powerless. This is the whole Republican right wing thing. I mean, look at our glorious invasion of Iraq. We spent 10 years disarming them, and then once they had no weapons, we invaded, you know?
Right. You're still participating?
Yeah, this is a little bit off the subject, but I think the North Koreans did the right thing. You get threatened by somebody like Bush, well, we build a nuclear weapon, you attack, we'll hit you.
Except the North Koreans are a little bit crazy.
Oh, they are, but...
they're not exactly the type of people you want to have a nuclear weapon, but neither are we.
Yeah.
We don't want anyone to have them. But, you're still participating in this group now.
Yeah.
Why are you still involved? What do you get out of it?
You know, I've always seen myself as a political person. I think this is a good political thing to do. This is... You know, working people, hey, look, you're not going to get anywhere by not organizing. And look, the workforce throughout the world is being moved and shook. And, you know, 30 years ago, if you said, well, you know, most cab drivers in New York were going to be from South Asia, people are like, well, you're out of your mind. But if you look back now, seeing trends that were put into effect then, yeah, it makes a lot of sense. We see this. Yeah, as I was saying about how you understand these things intellectually and then emotionally. Well, you know, I always knew plenty of immigrants in the city. And I know a lot of people didn't have papers and everything. But until you go on something like a strike, you don't realize just how many, you know. As I said, you see this, but it doesn't really register on you what it means, you know. This is a, 40% of the population of New York City now doesn't speak English at home. That's a very interesting, very significant statistic. This is we think, well, it's only happening in New York. But you go to London, you go to Paris, it's probably the same thing. It's, we always think in America, we always think in the late 19th century, it's the great wave of migrations. But by today, that was a little ripple compared to what's happening now.
Right.
You know, hey, it's a lot cheaper, and you know, the demand for labor is worldwide.
Right. Now, just going back for a second to the day of the first strike, I mean, you'd been a driver for so long and you'd seen the collapse of this old union. And what was it like for you to come out on the street and see absolutely no one lined up outside Port Authority?
Well, you know, you figure, well, hey, you know, we can do it. This is, drivers also tend to have low opinions of other drivers too. That, well, you know, we're all out there competing with each other. We'll never get organized. It's that's one of the biggest advantages bosses have. That, well, you know, we can't get organized. We can never win. What can we do? It's sort of, you know, the thought that you'll be defeated in any case. You know, winning is a nice feeling.
Even only for a day, right?
If only for a day, but hey, you know, drivers hadn't won in a long time.
So the last thing is, you were saying about Oh, were you one thing I want to know is, were you afraid at any point during this action, during this set of actions? What were you afraid of, if so?
Oh, well, yeah, you're always afraid. I mean, you know, I really didn't expect I was going to get beat on the head by a cop or something, but you worry about, you know, the bosses, you know, you're going to lose your job, you're going to... They say you're not an employee, but they treat you as an employee, you know. It's, you know, the cops aren't going to, probably not going to beat you up, and again, give you like 800 tickets, you know. You know, I don't know if you've ever seen the VTL, the Vehicle and Traffic Rule Book. It's this thick, 1,000 pages. And if a cop wants to give you a ticket, he'll always find something.
Okay. So, I think that's about it, except the one thing you said that was so interesting was 30 years ago, if anyone had said that, you know, the majority would be South Asian, they would have said you're crazy. And yet there were trends kind of leading that way.
Oh, yeah. Economic trends. Go back. Well, you make a case, they go all the way back to the 19th century. But, hey, you know, by the 60s, you have multinational corporations, you know, communications revolutions and everything. Hey, by the 60s, in the 19th century, it would have taken you 6 months on a boat to go to India. You know, even in the 60s, you could do it, in 20 hours, you know. This is a big change. It's a big change.
Now, are most of the workers coming from South Asia, are they undocumented, or do they have...
No, cab driver, well, nobody knows. Cab drivers, actually before 9/11, I think a lot of guys had, you know, document problems. You know, native-born Americans tend to think of immigration as, well, either you have a green card or you don't. I mean, I only realized, started talking to people, I mean, just there are so many gradations that, you know, people are talking about 1H status and 2Q status, and it's very important if you're an immigrant. I mean, you know, I'm lost on it, but, you know, it's a Byzantine maze. It really is. I don't even think the people who really run the system know how it works. But... Yeah, this is, and remember, it's also, you know, predominantly a Muslim population. And, Muslims are now, you know, America's enemies, you know.
So after 9/11, most of the drivers had to be documented.
A lot of guys just went back to, you know, Pakistan or you know, mostly Pakistanis. They were the ones that was the ethnic group that was hit the hardest. Okay.
All right, got it. Was there anything else you wanted to add? That?
Oh, no, I can't think of anything.
All right, that's very helpful. So what I'm going to do it now is I'm going to get a minute of dead sound just for editing purposes, and then I'm going to take a picture of you for our website.
Oh, okay.
And then I'll be all done, so just give me 1 minute.